people would always ask me, well, who's the idiot? And I would say, oh, whoever you want it to be. I mean, is the listener the idiot? Maybe, because you take such delight in the show. And people would always say, I'm one of your delighted idiots, you know?
From Louisville Public Media, this is Five Things, the show that tells a life story through the objects we treasure. I'm Tara Anderson. On each episode, we talk with someone about five physical objects that have meaning in their life. This week, my guest is a professional talker, and we were in his studio instead of mine. Vin Scalza is a familiar name to anybody who grew up listening to FM radio in the New York, New Jersey area. And if you didn't, stay with me. You'll enjoy meeting him. He spent nearly 50 years playing music on the radio, starting out at a college station, then a couple of commercial stations before heading to public radio. I met Vin when we were both working at WFUV in the Bronx, that's Fordham University's public radio station, and he was doing a weekly show called Idiot's Delight. He's retired now, and I visited him last summer at his home in suburban New Jersey, where he and his wife Freddie had bagels and coffee waiting for me. After we ate and caught up, we went into his home studio to talk.
My name is Vin, not Vinny, not Vince, not Vincent, Vin Scalza. And for 47, 48 years, I was on the radio in the New York, New Jersey area, doing very kind of freeform radio that when we started, when I started, there was no we, it was just me, 1967, at a little radio station called WFMU in East Orange, New Jersey. It was part of a college called Uppsala College, where I wound up only because my girlfriend at the time, who is my wife all these many years later, we got married in 1970, she was going to college at Uppsala. And I was not going to college at all because I was going through my my Jack Kerouac phase. I was going to just do like blue-collar stuff and eventually wind up in a tower in the mountains somewhere looking for forest fires. I mean, that's what I thought I was, and write poetry.
That's a respectable plan.
Yeah, well.
But it didn't work out
It didn't, no, it didn't happen that way. I followed her to college, first going at night and then swinging over to the daytime and discovering an exciting group of people, very small. I mean, Uppsala was a Lutheran-oriented school, and there were a lot of, like, blonde-haired, blue-eyed people from the Midwest, Lutherans, you know, who came to school in East Orange, New Jersey, which wasn't quite as African-American dominated as it is now, but it was a fairly urban, you know, city.
Yeah.
But there was this small group of people based around the theater mostly who were very exciting and who fit right into my Jack Kerouac, Allen Ginsberg, bohemian look at the world, you know. And in 1967, she and I started working for the college literary magazine. And the offices were downstairs in this little tumble-down house on the edge of campus. And on the second floor was the campus radio station, which was an FM station with an enormous signal that could reach into Manhattan and
wow.
parts of Brooklyn and, you know, Staten Island and the whole, like, the college was doing nothing with it. It was like a club. It would sign on during, you know, if a kid felt like signing it on that afternoon. And I started spending less time in the poetry office downstairs and more time just looking around upstairs. And I had fallen under the influence of WBAI, which was a public radio station in New York, and specifically a guy named Bob Fass, who was doing a show called Radio Unnameable. And that's what I decided I wanted to do then. I never wanted to do it for my life, but I wanted to do radio then because it was 1967, 68, and it was an incredible time of the world exploding.
This is kind of a funny question. How do you define freeform when it comes to radio?
Freeform when it comes to radio is when it's music oriented. Mm-hmm. It means to me, it always meant to me, that there was no form of music that couldn't fit in.
Yeah.
And that every form of music could be viewed on an equal basis with every other form. So yeah, rock and roll was the main form of music that was played. Rock and roll slash folk music back in the 60s and early 70s. But you could always play jazz, you could always play classical, you could always play world music. I mean, there was hardly even a term or an idea of world music back then. But I remember early on playing a Nonesuch recording from Bali called Music from the Morning of the World.
Ooh,
I think.
What a great title.
And it was the Balinese gamelan. It was these monks doing the Ketchak dance. It was this wild, crazy thing, you know. And Nonesuch was one of the few labels that was doing it at the time. And using the music to illustrate and illuminate what was going on in the world and in your own personal life, because the kind of radio I did was always very personal as well.
And we are here in your home studio in New Jersey, surrounded by CDs and LPs.
Wow. And dust and chaos. I stopped doing radio in 2015. And I used to, the last few years of both my broadcast radio at WFUV, where you and I cross paths, and also on Sirius XM Satellite, the last couple of years I did all my shows from here. So this was a very active room, but since 2015, since June of that year, I haven't done much except the podcasts that I do from time to time with my daughter. So the room has kind of deteriorated. As I say, it's returning to nature. I'm expecting to see plants growing in here anytime.
Some vines.
Yeah, some
possums
soon.
Or raccoons.
Yeah, exactly.
Do you have possums in New Jersey?
Yeah, we do.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, and we have wild turkeys.
So I asked you to pick out five things that have been important to you in some way or significant in your life, and we'll learn more about you that way. Let's get started.
What's the
first thing you want to talk about?
Well, the first thing is actually in 12. It's in 12.
Bending the rules already.
In 12 parts, but it counts as one specific item. It's a group of 12 record albums. They're long playing, but not quite the size of LPs.
Yeah.
They're a little smaller. They're 10 inches rather than 12 inches. It's called the RCA Victor Encyclopedia of Recorded Jazz in 12 Great Albums. And I have all of them. They were all collected in the mid-50s. I don't know if there's a date on these or not. Can you see down at the bottom? Maybe on the next one, the yellow one. No, I don't see a date.
No, I don't either.
The collection is still available. It's on CD now.
Uh-huh.
But this collection was a premium that was sold in the A&P between 9th and 10th Street in Bayonne, where I grew up, and Avenue C. That was our market, the A&P.
Yeah.
And they frequently had special items that were either part of some promotion for some food stuff or, you know, family product or whatever. And I don't remember what this was in conjunction with, if it was in conjunction with anything, but every month they would release a new volume, and they had a display on one of the aisles in this A&P. And my father was very enamored of jazz. He was a fiddle player, you know, amateur fiddle player, played piano by ear. Was responsible for turning me on to a lot of great music early on. And I just remember being very excited. This was probably 56, 57, and I was maybe 10 years old. The fact that I've had them all this time, they look old, but they're they're, what, 60 years old?
They look like they're in pretty good shape.
60 years old, yeah. We could still play them.
Uh-huh.
I've played these on the air my whole radio career. Mm-hmm. I've played these on the air. And there is a particular one. Can we play a little bit of it?
Yeah, let's.
Yeah? It's a Bix Beiderbecke recording. But it's not like a real jazz recording. It's more of a novelty recording. Let's open the turntable. It says Bix Beiderbecke with Hoagy Carmichael and his orchestra. The vocal chorus is by Hoagy Carmichael and somebody named Carson Robinson. So I'm not even sure what Bix Beiderbecke has to do with this recording.
Huh. See if we hear some trumpet on it.
Yeah. I always found it to be a fun novelty record to play on the air. You got to get that noise in.
Yeah.
That great sound of the... Well, yeah, it's a trumpet, clearly. Barnacle Bill the Sailor. Barnacle Bill the Sailor.
Who's that knocking at my door? Who's that knocking at my door? Who's that knocking at my door? Cried the fair young maiden.
It's only me from over the sea.
Barnacle Bill the Sailor.
I'm all lit up like a Christmas tree.
Barnacle Bill the Sailor.
I'll sail the seas until I croak. I'll fight and swear and drink and smoke, but I can't swim a bloody stroke.
Barnacle Bill the Sailor.
Here comes Bix.
Yeah, there you go.
And you know, I was on NEWFM and K-Rock. And
yeah, like rock stations.
Rock stations
here, yeah.
Playing this. And I would always get phone calls and letters from people saying, what the hell was that Barnacle Bill thing you were playing? And this is like such a fey vocal, this part here.
Yeah.
Yeah, you know, it's like very odd.
The fair young maiden.
Well, hurry before I bust in the door.
Barnacle Bill is here.
I'll rear and tear and rant and roar.
Barnacle Bill is here.
I'll spin your yarns and tell your lies. I'll drink your wine and eat your pies. I'll kiss your cheeks and black your eyes.
Ooh. Kiss your cheeks and black your eyes.
Drink your wine and eat your pies.
Yeah. So it's a pretty wild recording, isn't it great?
Oh my gosh. Yeah, beautiful.
And that, you can tell, I mean, it's still in great shape.
So you were 10, about 10 years old?
About 10 years old, yeah.
So that's not the typical thing for a 10-year-old to be into, is like, this was...
Right, this was
classic old music when you got it.
Yeah, I guess because of my father, I knew a lot about jazz music from the 40s and 30s.
Mm-hmm.
And very early on, and this brings me to my second object.
Okay.
Very early on, I was taken to see a movie called The Benny Goodman Story. Starred Steve Allen. Steve Allen became very famous for being one of those pioneer talk show guys on television. And he played Benny Goodman with the clarinet shoved up his behind, you know, orifice. I mean, he was very, like, very straight. And he never really bent his neck or smiled or anything. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't think that's what Benny was really like. But it was a great movie in that, in addition to being very Hollywood biography.
Mm-hmm.
So I fell in love with this, and I wanted to be Benny Goodman. He was like, next to Davy Crockett, he was, you know, my cultural hero.
Yeah.
I mean, it was either Davy Crockett or Benny Goodman, so you can see.
And since it wasn't really feasible for you to go conquer the West at that time. I mean.
So yeah. I wanted to play the clarinet.
Yeah.
And I just begged my parents, clarinet, clarinet, clarinet.
Mm.
And they finally bought me a toy clarinet, but it was a fairly accurate instrument. And so just having this toy made me crave the real instrument all that more.
And did you take lessons?
Well, So, finally, around 58, I guess, 10 years old. Oh, wait, no, I was 8 years old, so that's 55.
Okay.
This was the clarinet. It's a Buffet, the Yvette and Schaeffer by Buffet, Paris, France.
So right? Fancy. It's a beautiful little leather, yeah. It's like a suitcase.
And it's like a suitcase. The hinges are kind of broken, but it still opens up. And my dad got the clarinet. There was a famous family in Bayonne, the Morreale family. The Morreales were all musicians. I think one of the Morreales played in like the NBC orchestra and knew this clarinet saxophone player named Whitey Zarnicki.
Oh, what a great name.
Whitey Zarnicki. There were no vowels in his name at all, except for the I at the end.
Yeah, yeah.
And Whitey Zarnicki found this clarinet, which was, I'm pretty sure it was brand new when we bought it.
Ah.
My dad paid like $50 for it.
Oh, wow.
And the reason why it was so cheap was because the agreement was that Whitey would find the instrument, but then Whitey would teach me. And so I went for lessons. Let me put this together.
Mm-hmm.
I went for lessons every week up to Jersey City from Bayonne. We lived on 9th Street off the boulevard, between the boulevard and Avenue C.
Mm-hmm.
The A&P was around the corner on Avenue C. Either my father would drive, he sat in the back of the room.
Was the lesson in a shop or in his home?
In a home.
Uh-huh.
On Summit Avenue in Jersey City, near Journal Square. Since my dad witnessed the lesson, he would also sit with me when I practiced.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
So he was really interested in you improving and
taking
it in.
Well, he felt like if you're going to do it, do it.
Yeah.
You know, you have to practice. It's not just the toy,
mm-hmm.
like the other clarinet was. And if I'm going to spend the money and spend the time, then you better practice it.
Yeah.
I promised that I would practice an hour a day. And I did, except for when I balked, you know. And
for an 8-year-old, that's a lot of time.
It's a lot of time. Mm-hmm. It's a long time. Well, you can hear my lip is still not 100% there. But I've had the clarinet all these years.
Yeah.
And over the years, over time, the pads under some of the keys mm-hmm. just kind of rotted away.
Yeah.
And it got to the point where I couldn't play it anymore.
Mm-hmm.
Some of the keys were bent out of shape. And
mm-hmm.
about 2 years ago, I guess, my wife, Freddie, that same girl that I followed to college, she took the clarinet a while before my birthday and called up a guy. And he didn't do anything other than put new pads on it. There was one key ligature, or whatever the hell they're called. I don't know, one little part of this, of the keys that was bent out of shape that made it very hard to play.
Mm.
And he bent that back into
there
shape. So now that was the one song I learned to play that I could still play now today.
Yeah.
I could never pick out a particular melody.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the only music that I was interested in at the time. I mean, I had a subscription to Downbeat magazine.
Well, yeah.
You know,
did you ever play like in a school orchestra, or you were taking these clarinet lessons? Where did you play?
I played. Somebody started a classical orchestra, a symphony orchestra in Bayonne, and my dad and I both tried out for it. My dad on the violin, And we both made it in. It was basically an amateur.
Yeah.
It was called the Bayonne Little Symphony. When I was a sophomore in high school, I went away to, for lack of a more complicated description, I'll call it a seminary.
Okay.
It was the Marist novitiate from the Marist brothers, mm-hmm. you know, educators.
Yeah.
And I was going to be a Marist brother. That was like after jazz musician. That was, I wanted to be a Marist brother because they got to wear those cool robes, you know, with the rope tied around the middle that you could twirl the cinctures.
Are they the ones in the brown robes?
No, they wore black.
Black.
The brown, I think, are Franciscans.
Okay.
But similar, a similar
so
look.
So they got to wear the cool robes with the rope tied around
Yeah, the rope tied, the cincture tied around them.
What else about that attracted you?
Because
it can't just be the clothes, right? Although that sounds
well, the clothes,
cool.
clothes were pretty cool.
Yeah.
I was easily persuaded by things. You know, I was a very religious kid, even though I didn't go to Catholic school. The family is Italian Catholic, mm-hmm. so I went to catechism mm-hmm. classes, and I responded very well to the theatrics of the Catholic Church.
I think that's so underrated.
Yeah.
That's a huge part of it. Yeah.
The Latin, when I was a kid, it was still in Latin, and a lot of it was frightening, but I responded to it, and I used to have these terrible fears because there had been several movies that came out in my childhood about visitations, you know, like Bernadette of Lourdes.
Yeah.
You know, like where Bernadette was in a field one day and the Blessed Virgin appeared to her.
Yeah.
And God damn, is that frightening to a little kid, you know?
Yeah.
They're like ghost stories.
They are.
I mean, it's like some apparition, you know? I mean, just because it's the Blessed Virgin and she says, oh, peace be unto you and all, doesn't mean that it's not still incredibly frightening. And I used to be totally afraid of, for instance, in Bayonne on 9th Street, we still had coal heat in the house. And when I reached a certain age, probably around 10, I got to be one of the people responsible for putting coal in the furnace.
Yeah.
And I would go down into the basement, which was ill-lit and had this coal bin and, you know, these dark corners
yeah.
where any number of saints and Jesus and his friends could have been hanging out, you know. And I didn't want them to appear to me. I thought I was a holy enough kid who prayed and went to catechism and studied and did all that, that it would be great. I mean, what a blessing to have the Blessed Virgin appear to you, right? And create miracles in your...
In your basement.
In your basement. But who would want that? You know, why would you want, as a 10-year-old kid, why would you want that? So I was terrified of it. But I was susceptible to it. And the drama of the church and the rituals of the church,
yes.
It seemed like beautiful stuff. Mm-hmm. When I came of age, in the 60s, I thoroughly bought not so much the hippie philosophy, because I wasn't a hippie.
Explain what you consider to be the hippie philosophy.
Well, the hippie philosophy was just like smoke pot and peace man. And,
yeah.
And, you know, I mean, some of that was a part of my thing. And this is going to lead us to item 3.
Perfect.
Sounds like I could plan this, and I really didn't. But it will lead us to item 3. I bought the beat philosophy.
Mm-hmm.
You go with the flow. Don't create any harm. You do your thing. And somehow out of that came a real lack of motivation. I didn't have any ambition.
Mm-hmm.
And I still have it today. I'm about to turn 70 this winter. And I still have no ambition. I still have no drive. People say to me, oh, you should be writing your memoirs. And so I don't want to write my memoirs. That's work. I don't want to do work, you know. So when we were at FMU, though, there was that element. This was actually a few months before, maybe even a year before FMU. Some of this crew, this college crew, attended the first New York be-in. Now, Ginsberg and others were responsible for putting together the first be-in, which was in the Summer of Love in San Francisco.
Yeah.
Whenever it was, a year later, there was one in New York, in Central Park. And it was the first time that all those people actually saw each other in a particular place. And that was what was special about it. So it was before Woodstock, certainly.
Okay.
They used the phrase gathering of the tribes.
Yeah.
Because when you stood like on an elevated spot looking out like over the sheep meadow, you could see various groups of people with pennants and colors flying from erected poles.
Yeah.
And that's what it looked like. It looked like the colors of tribes or armies, even, you know. Well, I had this old, what's the way to describe this? Like a jungle helmet?
A pith helmet.
Pith helmet, yeah.
And when you tapped it, little puffs of dust.
Yeah, dust came off it. Because it's been collecting dust ever since. And I still have it. And I painted it. It's the most non-hippie, non-psychedelic paint job, right? That shows you that I was never a visual artist. It's just lots of colors painted on, and there's like polka dots and stripes and things, but it doesn't have any of that 60s hippie psychedelic look to it.
Mm-mm.
But I painted it for the be-in,
and
I had an actual real flower in one of the air holes on the head portion, but now there's a plastic flower, which somehow has been there forever. I don't remember how it got there, but it still fits me. And it is a recollection of those years when I was on the cusp of becoming an adult. But this, I think it's a cool object, not dart, but object something. Object personal.
Yeah.
And the fact that I still have it, and I found it this morning.
What else did you wear with that hat? Do you remember?
Oh, the rest of my clothes were very much jeans and t-shirts.
Mm-hmm.
I never went in for flowery.
So this was your
clothing.
Only touch of whimsy.
Yeah. A touch of whimsy is exactly what it was and what it is still. And when I got to FMU a year later, I was sort of the grown-up of that group. Some of the air people bordered on hippies, but most weren't. Because to be a hippie was like the opposite of a certain kind of work ethic that was needed to run a radio station.
Sure.
You know, even for the DJs, you had to be there at a certain time, at a certain day, and, you know, you couldn't just smoke pot all the time, which doesn't mean we didn't smoke pot all the time, but but we didn't get dressed up like flowery vests, and maybe some of the girls maybe did, but, you know, girls had that freedom more than boys did, really, still. But I was the grown-up. I was the one who stood up on the balcony of the second floor. We eventually took over the whole building. The Poetry Magazine moved out, and there would be people. The hippies would actually sort of congregate in one of the rooms downstairs where they'd sit and listen on headsets and smoke dope and stuff. And I would stand up on the balcony looking down, and I would yell at everybody for the mess that they were making.
Oh.
And I'd say, who's going to clean this up? Huh? I'm not going to clean it up. I'm not your mother. Echoing my mother. From a few years earlier, you know, what? You think we got a maid? We don't have a maid. Clean this crap up.
Thank you.
turns, it's evidenced by this plaque that was made for me that has the words on it on a kind of a, it's like a slate almost, right? A dark green colored slate maybe with yellow writing on it. And it says, in quotes, there are three essential commandments. Respect the elders, embrace the new, encourage the impractical and improbable without bias. Close quotes. And then it says, it gives credit to the author. The author is David Frick, who was for many years an editor, music editor and writer at Rolling Stone magazine and a writer of many things with regard to music and was a friend of mine. Mm-hmm. And 1 year, this was back in the 80s, Frick wrote for Rolling Stone about the very first South by Southwest festival in Austin, Texas. And somewhere in this piece, he wrote those words.
Oh, wow.
He says, well, you know, the essential theory that kind of overrides everything is that there seem to be three essential commandments. Mm. Respect the elders, embrace the new, encourage the impractical and improbable. And I looked at that and I thought, my God, that's like what I do on the radio. That would be a perfect opening statement, an introduction to the show. And we got in touch with David. He was a fan of mine as well as an, an acquaintance. We weren't really friends, but we knew each other, and he had been on the show and everything. And he was very honored when I said, I want to take your words, and I won't give you credit for it each time, but, you know, every once in a while I will mention that you did write them, not I.
Yeah.
And over the introduction to John Coltrane's A Love Supreme, Part 1, I recorded reading, there were three essential commandments, you know, they're doing a voice. You
anybody
know,
who's heard your show, that that phrase is very familiar.
And that's really from the very first day of doing radio, that describes what I tried to do. I played the elders. I played Benny Goodman. I played Pete Seeger and Lead Belly. And, I played those guys. And I played the Grateful Dead and the Jefferson Airplane and the Fugs and people like that. And my whole career has been based on finding the new young bands that nobody else wants to listen to. The They Might Be Giants of the world.
Yeah.
And putting them on the air and hoping that something happens for them.
Oh, and there are so many people who either respect the elders or embrace the new. To keep both of those in your head at the same time, I think that's really key.
You have to do that, yeah. Because otherwise, you lose track of the continuity of things. You lose track of the line that can be drawn from history to the present, and it will move to the future. And without that, if you lose track of the existence of the line and that somebody always comes along to pick up the line and move it on, then there's no reason to have any hope in the future. Like if you can see the course from Woody Guthrie to Pete Seeger to Bob Dylan to Bruce Springsteen, to the next guy, whoever that is, who's going to pick up that mantle and carry it through the rest of this century, then the future looks bleak.
Right.
But if you can see that we made it from Woody Guthrie in the 1930s to Bruce Springsteen in the 20-teens, and we're still here, you know, we may not have the government we want or the leaders that we want, but we're still here.
Yeah.
We've survived. We went through World War II. We went through the civil rights movement and the gay movement and, you know, various things that we thought we would never actually overcome. And we still haven't overcome completely. But there is hope for the future because there is that line.
Yeah.
So embrace, you know, respect the elders, embrace the new. It's like you got to do that because It doesn't work otherwise.
I wonder if I have it here.
Yeah.
Let's see what this one is.
Attention listeners, the following program is completely spontaneous.
Oh, so this, the attention listeners thing, I started in the 80s after I began working at the same station as Howard Stern. When Howard first came to New York, he was at NBC.
Uh-huh.
And then he went to K-Rock.
Uh-huh.
And we both went to K-Rock in the same year, a few weeks apart. And just all the stuff that he used. The beginning of his shows, I don't know, they were always pre-recorded bits
yeah.
and pieces and things. And I kind of got inspired to do this thing where I recorded my voice and then put it through a computer and made
yeah.
it sound like it wasn't me. And it was sort of like a caveat emptor thing,
uh-huh.
you know?
Attention listeners, the following program is completely spontaneous, unplanned, unrehearsed. The following program welcomes serendipity and frequently relies upon the inspiration of the great radio muse for its direction. The following program gets lost in maze-like tangents, long parenthetical thoughts, and wayward digressions. The following program is a radio fiction derived from notes jotted on soggy paper napkins, a box of scribbles found hidden in the basement, a closet full of warped LPs. It is, if you will, a never-ending work in progress. It is, if you will, old-style freeform radio. Presenting Ben Skelsey's Idiot's Delight.
You know, big fanfare.
Yeah.
There it is.
What it comes down to is this. There are three essential commandments. Respect the elders. Embrace the new. Encourage the impractical and improbable without bias. This is Idiot's Delight.
And then depending upon whether it was the radio show or the satellite show, there was a different piece of opening music.
Okay.
This was the music that I opened with on FUV.
Yeah.
On the satellite show, I opened with East St. Louis Toodaloo by Ellington. Ellington and the big band.
Yeah. How does that make you feel to hear this music and hear this opening again?
Well, you know what? It's funny. I hear it every once in a while because it's on my iPod, and I've never removed it for whatever reason.
So it just like
so
comes
it just
up?
Comes up sometimes.
Oh wow!
And I usually run quickly to push to advance it so I don't have to listen to it. It didn't make me nostalgic or anything.
Ah, oh, uh huh.
You know. It makes me feel good. I know that people really related to it.
Tell me about the name of your show, Idiot's Delight. Where did that come from, and what did that mean to you?
So, at some point, again, it may have been because of Stern and because of the sense of show. Up until that point, I had always just been Vin Skelsey. You know, the DJs were not interchangeable parts, because we all had such distinct personalities
yeah.
on NEW back in the day.
Mm-hmm.
But nobody, it wasn't the Vin Skelsey show or anything. It was just, hi, I'm Vin Skelsey, WNEW.
Right, and this was your time on the air.
Yeah, this is mm-hmm. my time on the air. So when I started doing Sunday mornings on K-Rock, I thought, well, the show should have a name. It's different from everything else. Because they were a classic rock station, too, when Stern first started
yeah.
there. I saw on television an old movie called Idiot's Delight with Clark Gable and a woman named Norma Shearer. And Gable plays the part of a song and dance manager of an all-female orchestra that gets stuck on a European tour in the Swiss Alps just at the outbreak of World War II.
Oh, wow.
And it's a comedy, but it's okay. A comedy with... It's originally a play. Uh-huh. The author's name is Robert Sherwood. The film version of it dilutes a lot of the seriousness of the play, mm-hmm. but the play is all about war profiteering and just being in dangerous places and what it's like to be an artist in a dangerous place and all that. And it's just like Idiot's Delight. And, you know, just and it's song and dance. And
yeah,
it's the one time in film, if you ever want to, like, win a trivia contest at a party or something, it's the one film where Clark Gable sings and dances.
Oh.
He sings Putting on the Ritz and does a little dance to it. And I thought, that's a great name. Who's the idiot? And then I explored it a little more, and I discovered that there was actually a version of Solitaire. Idiot's Delight is a version of Solitaire that's very, very difficult to win. I used to know how to lay the cards out for it, and I never once won. And to me, using that as the name of the show harkens back to having a closet full of music. Idiot's Delight is a card game, is like shuffling the cards, mm-hmm. and whatever cards come up, that's what you play. Yeah. That's the hand that you play. Mm-hmm. And so with Idiot's Delight, the music was now, instead of being music in a closet, it was cards shuffled and dealt out in a card game. And people would always ask me, well, who's the idiot? And I would say, oh, whoever you want it to be. I mean, is the listener the idiot? Maybe, because you take such delight in the show. And people will always say, I'm one of your delighted idiots, you know? And eventually there was an email group that got together called the Idiot's Delight Digest. And they referred to each other as idiots. But I always thought of myself, really, as the idiot. Because I delighted first before anybody else in what I was doing.
Perfect.
It occurs to me that even though we haven't done the fifth object, that I had a lot of objects that were multiple. Mm-hmm. Could we do the fifth object as these CDs that had the...
Have all your sound effects.
Have my sound effects and things on?
It's up to you.
Because I'm just too tired to do the other thing.
That's okay. Well, I have one last question that I ask everybody.
Okay.
In putting together these objects and thinking about these things, was there anything that you learned about yourself in the process? It's an easy question. I mean, really.
I guess no. I don't think I learned anything. Well, I guess I relearned about the effect that the church had on various aspects of my life that I wouldn't have obviously connected back to the church, mm-hmm. which is the whole sense of theatricality, the whole sense of doing a show. I mean, I think I've known that at times in my life, but yeah, I did relearn that during the course of this conversation, mm-hmm. not so much picking the objects, but in talking about the objects.
Yeah, because it strikes me that the priest leading the mass is also the ringmaster, mm-hmm. the DJ, mm-hmm. the host.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I wasn't going
to
be...
to use that word two different ways.
I don't... the host... I didn't want to be a priest. I wanted to be a teaching brother.
Uh-huh. Okay.
But it's a similar mm-hmm. kind of thing. It's the teacher, the head of the class mm-hmm. who brings all the information and imparts it. And there was that sense of also with the other end of the religious thing, the priesthood, of being a proselytizer, of spreading the word. Yeah. About music. I've always felt that was a big part of my reason for doing radio, was to to spread the word about these artists. That was that aspect of it, the proselytizer, the spreader of the word.
I hadn't put it together like that, but yeah, that
well,
makes perfect sense.
We've both learned something from this show. This has been great fun. Thank you for inviting me.
Thanks again to Vin Scalza for being my guest. Today's show was produced, edited, and mixed by me. Our executive producer is Stephen George, editing help from Erica Peterson. We had music from Benny Goodman, Dream Academy, and Blue Dot Sessions, and our theme music is by Alex Wright. You can get more information on our show at WFPL.org, and please subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks for listening.